Yeah, thank you, Boris. It's good to be back here in Santa Barbara, and today it's even the sun came back. It's very much appreciated. I don't think I've ever talked to a room full of teachers. Maybe only that one time when we got in trouble for some hacking into the school computer. And I had to face a room full of teachers. Well, the password was Goethe. What was the second guess? Name school. But yeah, it didn't take long. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about evolution and sort of try to give you an idea why this might be an area where sort of ideas from physics come in handy. And I also want to convey the idea that evolution is really happening sort of on an everyday basis. It's nothing that sort of necessarily takes sort of many millions of years to observe. So there's been a couple of evolution has been mentioned a couple of times, and just because this is mostly a physics audience, I thought I might just review sort of the very basic cartoon picture of what we have in mind when we talk about it. So there's a population. Each of these individuals of the population has a particular genotype. That means the string of letters in its DNA sequence, A, T, C, G, and so forth. Each of these individuals sort of has developed into sort of a grown-up, which is a certain set of phenotypes. So I just took a couple of giraffes here. These grown-up giraffes, they are supposed to reproduce and sort of makes this cycle go around, so from one generation to the next. But the success at which they reproduce will depend on their features. Sort of giraffes with longer necks sort of get to eat sort of more of the green leaves, have more offspring because they're better nourished, and so forth. And then they reproduce. And during this process of reproduction, you sort of get genetic diversification. And that would be once by mutation, meaning you sort of change individual letters of your genetic code from one particular base, say A to G. But in addition to that, there's sort of another mode of genetic diversification, and that is sort of sex and recombinations, by which you take sort of existing genetic variation and just reassort and sort of put it together in different combinations. And so this cycle goes around all the time. Selection removes variation, mutation and recombination reintroduces variation. And well, that is sort of, you know, not knowing about genes and anything that goes on down here, that was kind of Darwin's idea. And well, this over so 4 billion years sort of gave rise to the biological diversity we see on the planet. There are sort of animals, sort of amphibians, mammals, sort of arthropods and what kind of stuff up here. Then there's bacteria, there's the archaea, sort of Rob Phillips alluded to, there's plants. And you know, really this part is the tree is sort of very anthropocentrically sort of blown up. This part is much, much larger. But anyway, so the one problem we are facing when studying evolution, that all we see really is these tiny tips on the very end of the tree. So we have very little information what actually sort of happened down here, but for some fossils that we happen to dig out. But these fossils are not going to be these branch points, but sort of some dead ends out here. So if we want to say something sort of more quantitative about evolution, you kind of have to zoom in. And one place where people like to zoom in is, for example, fruit flies. Fruit flies got mentioned in Boris's talk before. They are sort of a favorite model organisms of geneticists because, well, much easier to study than giraffes because you can put many of them into one lab and they reproduce in a scale of weeks. So one sort of very nice resource to study evolution these days is sort of the Drosophila phylogeny. You have a bunch of different Drosophila species, which diverged some 40 million years ago. And for each of them, we have the complete genome sequence available. And they're very well annotated, so you can spot genes, you can compare genes, and so forth. But still, we can only really sort of look at the tips of this tree. And the genome is pretty long. It's 120 megabases. And the differences between these species are typically on the order of a couple of percent. So if you have a 120 megabase genome, you're dealing with sort of millions of differences between these species. And it's very hard to attribute sort of phenotypical changes between these flies, which after all look kind of similar, to any of these millions of differences. So if we want to sort of zoom in even more and sort of get some better idea of the dynamics that's going on, one thing we can look at, for example, is the evolution of viruses. For example, influenza A, which this sort of kind of messy tree, but shows different influenza sequences that are sampled from the 1918 influenza pandemic to, like, I think it stops in 2005. And before, we were only having information on the endpoint of this evolution, like information of the present state of the influenza populations. But here we have lots of frozen samples that have been preserved, and we can look at the genetic composition of the influenza population, say at 1940 or 1918. And from that, we can really reconstruct the evolutionary trajectory this virus took over time. And yeah, as it happens, this evolution sort of basically is producing these recurring influenza epidemics and pandemics we have every other year. Another instance where evolution can be observed on sort of a scale of a couple of years would be HIV. And rapid evolution of HIV, so this is a sort of a small sketch of HIV. It has sort of its it's a sort of a envelope proteins here, so it has a lipid envelope. Then there's its genome is composed of two RNA strands, which are normally identical to each other. Why HIV is so hard to eradicate really is its rapid evolution. And just to sort of remind you of sort of the typical course of an HIV disease progression. So HIV typically, when people get infected with HIV, the level of virus in the blood, which is sort of this shown as these red triangles here, shoots up dramatically. So this is on a logarithmic scale. It shows the number of virus particles per milliliter of blood plasma, or the number of RNA per milliliter of blood plasma. It shoots up to sort of, you know, more than 10 to the 6 within a couple of weeks, and the patients are sick as if they had flu. Then sort of the adaptive immune response kicks in, and this viral level drops tremendously after sort of like the first 2 months of the infection. And then sort of these patients enter some kind of a chronic stage of the disease where the virus continues to replicate within the patient at a very much lower level, sort of, you know, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 RNA copies per milliliter. And there aren't sort of many clear symptoms. You can only sort of detect it if you do sort of a blood test against HIV proteins. But during this whole sort of time window, which can last up to several years, the virus is sort of constantly evading the human immune system, because it is evading the human immune system by sort of modifying its genetic makeup and its protein so that it's no longer recognized by the existing sort of white blood cells and antibodies in the body. And this rapid evolution really is what, so at least part of what makes it so hard to develop vaccines against the virus and to develop and for the immune system to eradicate it entirely. And here again, so similar to the case of influenza, we actually have sort of time series data. We can look at how the virus changes within individual patients. And it changes a big deal. So this is sort of one such phylogenetic tree where each of these tip points here again represents sort of one sequence of the virus of a particular region of the virus genome. And we have samples that, so this is the time of infection. So forget about these minus 2, minus 1 here. It just takes a couple of years. This patient has been followed every 6 months over a couple of years. And each of these endpoints represents a sequence that has been sampled here at sort of year 1.3, kind of, or year 5, and so forth. So we have this whole molecular fossil record of the evolution that happened here. And if you compare a sequence that got sampled in the end to a sequence that got sampled in the beginning, it is sort of different at roughly sort of 7-8% of its nucleotide positions. And if you sort of put that into perspective, this Drosophila phylogeny I showed you a couple of slides back, which covered a time span of 40 million years, the distance were roughly comparable. So there's really a tremendous amount of evolution going on in a very short time. And this, together with the fact that we can actually, so we understand a lot about the virus, allows us to study evolution in kind of a microcosm, and hopefully allows us to draw some sort of conclusion about evolution in general. So why does this virus change so much more rapidly than most other organisms we know? First of all, the virus kind of has to change. If it didn't, it would get eradicated. So this driving force, for change is a big component of it. And it not only evades the immune system, but it also evades sort of antiretroviral drugs. And just, well, you're not supposed to read this, but this is just an example of an amino acid sequence. So each of these letters here stands for a particular amino acid of one protein of the virus. It's a protease, which is the common target of antiretroviral drugs. And when patients get treated with this drug, the virus develops sort of mutations, so it changes its genetic makeup, such that the drug is no longer effective. And the upper column here, the upper row, sort of is a sequence of a drug-sensitive protease variant, whereas the lower column, lower row, is sort of a drug-resistant variant, which has sort of changed its genome at a whole bunch of positions. So here, from I to V, K to T, and so forth. And these positions, these changes, they confer drug resistance. But in order to be able to do that, the virus, first of all, needs a high mutation rate. And the mutation rate of the virus, so it's 3 × 10⁻⁵ per generation and sort of position in the genome, this is roughly a factor of 1,000 higher than the number of mutations that separate kids from parents, like in humans. So the rate in humans is sort of 10⁻⁸, 10⁻⁹, so something depends on how many germline generations you count and whether you look at males and females and stuff. There's more mutations than males, generally. Then again, sort of the virus also has a very high mutation rate. Very, very high population size, mutation rate, I already said. So if you just multiply these two numbers, every single mutation is going to be present sort of a couple of thousand times every replication in the patient. So there's mutations are being produced at a rate that is pretty inconceivable sort of for sort of large eukaryotic populations. But every single site is present in all its forms. And then you can ask sort of, you know, how much of the combinations of different possible forms are present? And you'll see that roughly sort of, yeah, you can still find pretty much every possible combination, but every possible triple is pretty much impossible. So then there's another aspect to the very rapid evolution of HIV, and that is its ability to have some kind of viral sex. So it does reproduce sexually in the sense that different virus particles in the patient exchange bits and pieces of their genome. And the way they do it, so I told you before that the virus sort of carries two copies of its RNA genome. So it's indicated here in green and in red. And when a virus infects a human immune cell, it produces sort of one copy of these two strands. And when producing this copy, it hops from one of these strands to the other, producing these red-green sort of, well, first the cDNA, and then from the cDNA, it produces a whole bunch of new RNA, which then get packaged into new viruses. So this is, yeah, it really is sort of very reminiscent of sexual reproduction in higher organisms. And this by no means is a peculiarity of HIV. Pretty much all organisms do it to some extent. There's very, very few organisms known that don't have a sexual mode of reproduction. Even bacteria do. They sort of exchange snippets of their genome. And one sort of instance where this is quite prevalent, or at least sort of believed to be rather important, is influenza. So this is a sketch of influenza A virus. Influenza, again, is sort of an envelope virus, but its genome now comes in 8 different pieces rather than 2. And the two pieces aren't, so in HIV, you had 2 copies of the same stuff. Here you have 8 segments, all of which are different. So this is like 8 chromosomes. And, well, these chromosomes have complicated names, but so they, in the natural population out there, these chromosomes come in many different variants. And the way we classify these viruses, that is by sort of the variant they carry at 2 particular segments here. One would be the hemagglutinin. So the segment of the genome that codes for the protein hemagglutinin, which is the one that sticks out here and helps the virus to sort of attach and get into cells. And then there's another one that's a new, the thing that codes for the neuraminidase. That's another protein that's recognized that's on the outside of the cell. And these segments are important. The stuff on the outside of the virus is important because these are the ones that are recognized by the immune system. and therefore are the change most quickly and also are the easiest to classify. So there, in total, there are sort of 16 different variants of this hemagglutinin H thing and 9 different variants of these neuraminidase. And when you hear in the media about sort of H1N1 viruses, so H2N2, H3N2, these sort of names, they refer to the particular type of segments, genomic segments, the virus carries. And so of H1N1 is sort of this swine flu thing. So much of that. It's a segmented virus. It has different segments. But now what happens when sort of two viruses infect one cell? You get a whole soup of these different things. Somehow the virus manages to sort them again, that each of these carries just about one of each. But you can have a whole zoo of sort of different reassortments of these segments. So this is some kind of a sexual reproduction. Not that you have individual chromosomes that are being crossed over, but sort of you have different bits and pieces that can be put together in different combinations. And yeah, so pandemics are believed, so these huge outbreaks are believed to follow sort of reassortment when some new variant comes up, which is sort of different than anything we have seen before, and therefore can spread sort of rather uninhibited through through the population. And sort of while listening to Boris's talk, I was kind of curious how it looks like this year. And I went to the CDC website and pulled up sort of every week they put out this sort of influenza statistics. And what you see here is sort of weeks of years, 27 week 40, 2007 week 50, up to last week, kind of. This is sort of the last week of 2010, and right now we're here. So this curve here ends on February 19th. And what you see is that sort of the influenza cases right now are on the rise. So you have these nice seasonal patterns. They always sort of come and fall, so spike through the winter, and then sort of drop off again. And this year, they also provide you information about the composition of the cases that are currently being diagnosed. And this is sort of a blow up of the last tip, essentially being broken up in different types. And so this orange type here, that is the H1N1 2009 strain, which is sort of colloquially known as the swine flu thing. So roughly, a good fraction of the flu that's occurring this year is of the swine flu type. Then there is sort of a fair amount of the H3 type, the red stuff, and the yellow one is where they didn't determine the subtype, and the green one is influenza B, which is somewhat a different type. Anyway, that's just an aside. So what I really wanted to talk about, so why do these viruses bother and have this kind of funny sex? So if you think about how sort of evolution happens sort of at the scale of population, so you have sort of a population, each of these black bars is supposed to represent one genome. And if you have a mutation that happens on a genome, which sort of confers an advantage to the organism, meaning it replicates faster or has more offspring than everybody else, over time, this mutation will spread through the population, and at some point, everybody will carry it. But these populations are large, and I just told you that pretty much every mutation is present, and there might be several mutations at a time, which are good for the virus. So if this blue guy sort of also wanted to spread through the population, it kind of would have to compete with the red mutation in order to make it through the population. And this is sort of where recombination helps, because recombination can sort of cross over two of these genomes and combine two mutations on one genome. So you don't have to wait for this mutation to occur again, but you can basically make use of all the variation you have in your population and sort of somewhat innovate in parallel at different places in the genome. And then once these innovations are common, you can combine them into one genome and sort of benefit from that. By the same token, you can sort of separate the beneficiary mutations from the ones that are harmful. You know, most of the mutations that occur are actually screwing things up. So, because if you just sort of randomly change things in the genome, which is a pretty elaborate, sort of all these proteins are pretty elaborate structures, chances are that you're going to mess things up. So you want to get rid of these, but you want to sort of hold on to these rare things which actually make it better. So that's why this sexual reproduction is believed to be so universal and also sort of seen in viruses. So how can we quantify this? And basically, I'm going to sort of talk you through the same kind of thing again. So look at an R-section mutation, R-section population without recombination, and a small one at this. Mutations are going to be rare. So one mutation comes in, nothing happens for a long time. Next mutations come in, nothing happens for a long time. And the rate at which these mutations are accumulated is basically proportional to the rate at which they appear, which is proportional to the number of individuals that can generate these mutations. So we expect that the rate of evolution here is proportional to the size of the population. However, when the population gets large, we have these things coming up all the time, but only one of these things can spread at a time. And if you go through the mass, you basically have to, your rate of evolution is limited by the new mutation happening on the background of the previous. So how early after this clone is rising, it's spreading through the population, at some point the next one will arise. And you kind of have to sort of stick these little wedges into each other as densely as possible. And if you do some mass, you'll convince yourself that the rate at which these things happen then is no longer linear in the population size, but only increases logarithmically. So that's a big difference. And the conventional wisdom is that as soon as you have a little bit of sex, you can combine all these things readily, and none of these sort of interference between different things happen. And people sort of think, oh, yeah, OK, so sex is going to be very good. So the rate of evolution is sort of back to where we think it should be, being proportional to the population size. But the issue is actually much more subtle than that, because this really assumes that the recombination rate is much, much, much faster than everything else. But all we know about the microbial world is that recombination happens, but it's not terribly frequent. So we have to sort of do a more sort of quantitative analysis of this and can't really rely on this saying, OK, recombination is going to solve this problem, and we're done with it. So just to go through sort of one example. So let's come back to this drug-resistant example, where we have the drug-sensitive variant, and we kind of eventually want to arrive at one that has many, many, many mutations accumulated. And let's just assume for a moment that the amount of, these sequences get better, sort of in a more or less linear fashion, as they accumulate more of these drug-resistant mutations. And our population is large, so we have many of these mutations at the same time. Another way of representing that would be just to, bin these sequences. And I don't think this is the correct representation of that, but anyway. So make count how many sequences you have with zero drug resistance mutation, how many with 1, 2, 3, 4. So this one would end up in the 2 bin, this in the 1 bin, 1 bin, 1 bin, everything else in the 1 bin, really. So now what happens when selection is acting on this? These guys here, they replicate much faster than those guys, because they are drug resistant. So these bins are going to go up, these bins are going to go down, and as an effect, this sort of distribution is going to sort of shift towards higher fitness. So what happens now when a new mutation comes in? It will most likely sort of happen where the most individuals are. It's very unlikely that it actually hits this guy where there's very few. Most likely it will end up here. But if this guy is going to win anyway, this mutation is sort of a lost case. But if there is sex, so one of these guys can sort of recombine with some other guy and produce, put things together, 2 and 3, in a lucky way to produce this individual, which then is sort of even fitter than the fittest one we've had before. And sort of being in Santa Barbara, this kind of process reminds you of surfing. So you have this distribution that sort of shifts along. And the mutation, like a new beneficial mutation, kind of has to catch the wave and ride it until it finally is shared by the entire population. So OK, we're physicists, not surfers. So we kind of have to idealize things a little bit and sort of basically cast this problem into a mathematical framework. And what we sort of assume that we have some distribution, which now is sort of much smoother than the one I showed you before, which sort of represents the diversity of the population in terms of the drug resistance. And then what we want to ask is, given, so these mutations can occur anywhere here in this distribution. If they occur right in the tip of the distribution, they're golden. They're gonna catch the wave and surf. If they sort of occur right here in the back, they'll have to paddle a lot. And even if they do, they probably won't make it. So what you kind of have to calculate is, what is the probability that a mutation that comes in, that falls into this moving wave, what is the probability that it actually sort of ends up catching the wave? And this is sort of this function omega of x here, which, yeah, it's sort of a bit of a calculation. We can do it. But what one sort of finds is that so rather than sort of the rate of evolution being linear in the population size, you find that for the recombination rates that are sort of relevant for these microbial species such as HAV, you find that the rate of evolution, in fact, isn't linear in N, but it's still sort of logarithmic in the size of the population. But sort of one remarkable fact is that this prefactor of this logarithm depends on the recombination rate. So the more you recombine, the faster you evolve, and in fact, if you recombine twice as much, you evolve four times as fast. But what this tells you is that it really is sort of the bringing together of different mutations that is limiting the rate of evolution, rather than the supply of mutations in the first place. And that's kind of intuitive if you have, multiplied these numbers. So the population size and the mutation rate was so huge that every mutation is going to be there anyway. So this is not going to limit. So the input of mutations is not going to limit things. But what limits things is putting the right mutations together. Because if you had to wait for sort of all 12 mutations to occur at once, that would never happen. But they occur individually, independently in different individuals, and then you have to combine them. And that is kind of what limits the speed here. So, well, all the conclusions we can draw so far is that the more recombination, the better things get. There was just one R in front of this logarithm, and it would increase and increase and increase as we ramp up R. Now, you might also ask, does this hold true forever? Is there a cost to recombination? And I guess everybody can sort of think of a simple scenario where sort of a cost of recombination might occur. So say you took two soccer teams, which are sort of, they've played together for some time and they know each other and stuff. And then you just took all these players and sort of reshuffled them and made two new teams, so reassigned their jerseys like at random. Chances are that these two teams would fare much worse than the teams that sort of train together and know each other. But this is just saying that soccer teams don't really work like gymnastic teams, where you just add up the scores of the individual athletes. So we can sort of put that into some kind of a mathematical model. Say we have the fitness of our particular genotype. There might be sort of each of these I's now is a location in the genome. And each of these locations has sort of a specific effect on the fitness of the organism. That's this Fi. And Si basically tells you whether it's some sort of blue or red kind of, whether it's in one state or the other. But these Fi's kind of would be the gymnastic type contribution, where each of these players, each of these places in the genome, has a well-defined and contribution to fitness independent of what's happening elsewhere in the genome. But then you might also imagine that there are contributions which depend on sort of pairs of different places in the genome. So that this mutation, making something an A here, really only is beneficial if you make something else a G over here. And if you flip things around, it might actually not match up and things get much worse. So that would be sort of a term like this. And just to sort of get back to viruses, rather than sort of talking about soccer teams, very much the same kind of idea would apply to influenza. So you have all these segments, these eight genomic segments in an influenza virus, and they've been sort of evolving together for some time, and they are sort of adapted to work together. But once in a while, they end up infecting the same cell, and they all get mixed, and out comes this zoo of different viruses. And now the question is, how would this? There might be all kinds of incompatibilities here. How does this play out in an evolutionary sense? So say you started with sort of some diversity of sort of diverse of sort of influenza particles, and reassorting any of these sort of explores new variants, new combinations in the space of possible genomes. Whereas selection would always amplify those that do best. And so there's a competition between recombination that tries to diversify you in genotype space and explore different parts of genotype space, and genotype space being the different combinations of these different segments. Whereas selection wants to sort of concentrate all of the population into very few good combinations, into like one or two best genotypes. And you can study this kind of process in the computer. So if you had no recombination whatsoever, one of your initial genotypes, one of these guys, will be the fittest and eventually take over the entire population, so the purple guy here. But then you have recombination, and you produce new of these things along the way. So you see that this condensation into this one fittest occurs much later, and that there are sort of new guys coming up here, these color codes. This green one, for example, only arises somewhere here, but it's successful. And then if you crank up recombination even more, you sort of selection is no longer strong enough to hold these things together, but you mix things so fast that you basically lose all of these identifiable sort of genotype. But everybody is kind of unique, and none of these genotypes persists for any amount of time, but they just sort of are mixed up much faster than selection would be able to sort of amplify any of the good guys. So, and in fact, this is sort of very reminiscent of sort of phase transition type behavior you have in physics, where you have sort of an entropic contribution to your free energy that tries to diversify things. So, it tries to drive the system into a regime where the phase space is largest, where there's most possible microstates compatible with your sort of macrostate. And then there's sort of the potential energy contribution, which really wants to condense your population or your physical system into the minimal energy state. And we sort of have found that sort of rather similar ideas apply here, where you have the role of temperature kind of is played by the ratio of these recombination rates, so the rate at which the fraction of influenza that come out of co-infected cells rather than sort of ones that sort of breed on their own. And the other axis in this phase diagram-like thing would be played by the strength of these interactions, the degree to which it matters that you have a particular combination of genotypes, of segments and alleles, rather than just any sort of combination of good ones. So this is sort of one instance where sort of ideas from physics, in particular, is sort of reminiscent of the random energy model, which was put up as a model for sort of disordered systems some 30 years ago, kind of roughly, where this sort of inspired sort of our understanding of sort of various evolutionary processes. And sort of one final remark here, if you just go back here, you start out your population with a very diverse set of genotypes and just run it. At some point, all the variation is going to be lost, and the population is going to be sort of condensed. There's only going to be one genotype left, like here. Only that sometimes it takes much, much longer. But we can ask, so what is the fittest, the best genotype, how good is the genotype that we typically come up with when we run this sort of computer experiment to the very end? And how does that depend on the recombination? So this is plotted here. Down here, you again have sort of this recombination rate. And you have this final fitness of the genotypes that we found at the very, very end of our sort of in silico experiment. And without any recombination, you don't generate new diversity. So what you get out is kind of the fittest you put in. But as you crank up recombination, you try more and more of these genotypes. And you find better ones and better ones. So this is why this goes up. But at some point, you sort of try so hard, you try all over again, and you no longer hold on to these guys that are the best guys you found. And you get sort of a very sharp drop here in the fitness of this final genotype. And basically, you can sort of look at it as this being sort of the fitness of an all-stars team, because you've broken down all these, you're not holding on to the best possible genotypes. You're basically just selecting for sort of possible alleles of alleles that do best. So in most genotypes, you're selecting for sort of generalist alleles rather than sort of a particular combination of good alleles. And in some sense, this would be sort of the success of an all-stars team as opposed to sort of a very good club team where you have sort of switched, where you have sort of you know, selected players on the basis on how they fit into your team rather than just picking the stars of all possible teams. And this this sharp drop here, that coincides with this transition line I've shown you here. So why do we do all this, and how do we connect this to the theory? I don't think I'm glad nobody showed this slide yet. I was kind of expecting it. So this is how much it costs to sequence 1 megabase of DNA. Or that's not exactly fair. It's how much it costs to obtain a megabase of DNA sequence. So subtle distinction, but for the time being, that's fine. So it starts here in 2001. So it's over one decade. And for the longest time, it's been going down. It's on a logarithmic scale, so it has been going down exponentially with sort of a decay constant of roughly sort of 2 years. But then something happened at some point, and sort of the price of sequencing just plummeted. And what happened here is that people came up with new sequencing machines that instead of doing sort of one at a time, sequenced millions of things in parallel. Very short segments, but they produced millions of these in parallel. But all this is supposed to tell you is that over the last couple of years, the price of sequencing has dropped by a factor of 1,000. And this, of course, allows us to get huge amounts of data now. And we are kind of faced with the challenge of teasing out information out of these huge amounts of data. And I just wanted to sort of show you one quick application we are using to study HIV. This is sort of a study of drug resistance evolution within HIV patients. And what is sort of shown down here is sort of their treatment history. So these three-letter abbreviations, they stand for different drugs the patient got. And these little black arrows are when this patient got sampled and the virus in the blood got sequenced. And up here you see sort of some clinical characteristics of the patient, so the number of CD4 cells, that's a type of white blood cell, and sort of the amount of virus that is found in the blood. Again, the scales are here, somewhat hard to read. And in addition to that, you find sort of the prevalence of various well-known drug resistance mutations. So, for example, this one here, this is a mutation of methionine to valine at the position 184 in the reverse transcriptase gene. It's known to come up in response to this drug 3TC. And this guy got only sampled a couple of weeks after it first got 3TC. But the mutation, the prevalence of mutation is already at sort of 80%, meaning that there's a tremendous amount of selection going on here. And we can now, sort of having this deep sequence data, so we have roughly 10,000 sequences for each of these time points, pretty much as much DNA as RNA as there is in the sample in the first place. And we can see whether these kind of mutations, whether they pre-existed, for example, before treatment, whether they were just around, hanging around and waiting for for the drug to come up and then sort of rise in frequency and replace what has been there before. Another sort of striking fact is that once you, you know, stop therapy, so these drugs have pretty nasty side effects. So sometimes these drugs just get taken off because people can't stand it anymore. So it happened to this guy. And within a couple of weeks, all of these drug-resistant mutations are gone again. That doesn't necessarily mean they revert. But in fact, many of these sequences are pretty much identical to what you've seen before treatment. And that is because the virus integrates into long-lived cells and kind of has sort of an archive of virus of previous times. When times are right, this archive comes up again. OK, so I'm pretty much at the end of my show. So I just, so that as in short application, but well, sort of only a couple of years ago, or decades ago, what we were left with was sort of Darwin's elegance ideas, which were basically founded on sort of observations he has made and sort of by comparing different species, paleontology, fossils, and so forth. But we are now in a position where on the one hand, we can make experiments in the laboratory. We can sort of study evolution as it happens from with microbes and viruses. Santi is back there. He's doing one of our, in our program, he's doing lots of virus evolution experiments. We can sequence and phenotype a lot of these things, as I've just shown you in the previous slide. We also sort of start getting sort of metagenomic data, which means that people just go out into the into ecosystems like the ocean, take a bucket of water, and sequence everything that's in there. Or the gut, for example, or skin tissues, various comparing. People are comparing the microbiome, as they call it, like the, you know, the collection of microbes that you find in people's guts, and compare it from, you know, children to parents, for example. So how much of that is determined by the environment? How much of that is determined by, you know, where you get your microbes from? And these kind of questions. And there's a whole bunch of thousand genome projects, which basically aim at sort of providing a catalog of all the variation, the genetic variation that is in the human population, in various plant populations, in the fly populations, and so forth. And what you're trying to learn from this, basically, is how these genotypes, how genetic variation is distributed, how much it depends on geographic structure, how it relates to different phenotypes, how you map genotypes to phenotypes, and so forth. And on the other hand, we are sort of developing a much more quantitative theory of all this, and sort of try to develop these kind of prejudices and predictions we can test against what we see in these sources of data. Okay, so pretty much all of this is done in collaboration with Boris, Daniel Fischer was also part of this, and some of that, and Thomas Leitner. And yeah, so I promised that I'm going to show like just a couple of slides of what I alluded to before in the panel discussions. I'm not sure whether you want to ask your questions now, or whether I should sort of just hop through a couple of like two, three slides on this before. Do the slides first. So what I talked about is, or what I'm trying to mention, is this shop of my mother's, which she, it's called XLab, and it's located in Göttingen in Germany. And so this is their building, and it just got built a couple of years ago. And green is the bio floor, that's the chemistry floor, physics floor, and I think that's sort of math and IT floor. And it's located on the, so this is the science campus of Göttingen University. That's where this colored cube is. So this is chemistry, this is physics, med school is back here. So it's right in the middle of the science campus. And so what it is meant to do, it is meant to provide, so I don't, it's my mother, I can't take any credit for any of this. It's my mother who sort of did it. And I don't think I've ever talked about this at all. Anyway, so it's meant to provide some kind of science infrastructure and lab space for high schools, which, and so provides the equipment that isn't, you know, use it on a daily basis rather than, you know, if you do your experiments, you do them once a year or twice a year, and the rest of the year this is going to sit in some cupboard. But they are doing it throughout the year, and they have them maintained, and they're sort of skilled personnel that sort of provides these kind of things. And high school classes come together with their teachers for a couple of days, so somehow these schools manage to sort of accommodate that in their curriculum. And for a couple of days, these kids do nothing else but, so 25 kids coming with a teacher there, do nothing else but lab work. And it's sort of being supervised by scientists and sort of XLab-based teachers. And the whole thing is sort of a joint effort of the university and the various Max Planck institutes and other institutes in the area. And roughly, they're feeding through this building sort of 100 students a day. So on the order of sort of 10, 15,000 a year. And They have these lab courses throughout the school year, and then in holidays they have sort of summer camps and sort of courses for teachers and these kind of things. And well, my mother just, I asked her about it, she just sent me a couple of pictures. So this is, for example, I would have never thought that you get kids to do that, you know, dissect sort of pigs' hearts with sort of an anatomist from the university. But they come and do it. They have sort of molecular biology courses. They, you know, this is sort of some students sort of trying to set up a gel, a sort of microscopy facility. They do sort of neurophysiology. This is some Xenopus egg, which they sort of stimulate in various ways and measure sort of the electric responses of various cells. I don't have many pictures, so that's the only picture I have. I got from physics. So they have some kind of, they have some cloud chambers there, and sort of shows these kids how sort of ionizing radiation sort of leaves the traces in the cloud chamber. They also do sort of field ecology. So trying to get an idea what lives in lakes and in forest soil and stuff, and then take it back to the lab and analyze things. And they also do these science camps. So that's one of these science camps. It's usually some 20, 30 people from age 16, 17, kind of, which come from pretty much all over the place. And yeah, so they actually sort of franchising right now. They're building these things in China. But yeah, that's pretty much all I wanted to say about that. If you have more questions about that, I'm not the right person to ask, but anyway, I'll try.
Wondered whether there was a genetic factor in the virus that affects R itself. I mean, sort of a metagene.
That is certainly possible. And so, in the sense that you have sort of strategy evolution, that that's perfectly conceivable. So, in this case, in the case of HIV, this R is really very much dependent on the probability that two of these viruses meet in order to exchange information. They have to meet, and this will depend on the amount of viruses that's out there, and the amount of cells they have to that they can share. So I'm not sure to what extent this is an evolvable trait in HIV, but it's certainly conceivable. And I guess people are spending quite a lot of effort on sort of trying to figure things out.
Okay. I was curious about your use of entropy and Delta H essentially as an analog to thinking about selection and recombination, and how far you thought you could push that analogy if you were thinking it was a strong predictor or just kind of a general sort of interesting quasi-similarity.
Quasi-similarity. So it's dangerous to push it too far. So you have to, these are concepts which we kind of use to develop intuition and try to, arrange thoughts in our minds. But one has to keep in mind that things are different. There's no conserved quantities here, as energy, for example, would be in statistical mechanics. So this makes things a lot different. But some things can be carried over, some things can't, and one has to be careful in sort of keeping. So, staying honest here.
I'm not very familiar with this field, as this question will undoubtedly show. But I wonder, this makes me wonder if anybody is working on the admittedly frightening possibility of any kind of gene splicing to change R, which I guess you're saying we're not sure about yet, or even the possibility of introducing more of a population in some infections can cause actually a better condition.
I'm not sure.
In other words, that if R goes beyond a certain point, either because we find a way to do a little splicing, or because we actually introduce more organisms to actually meet each other, if that could actually have the strange counterintuitive effect of reducing an infection.
You mean sort of driving organisms?
Yeah, driving it up
threshold.
And then to drive it down.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit hard to see how you do that in practice, but there certainly are these. So people are seeing this. If you take two diverse populations and sort of cross them, you often have the effect that the fitness drops and then only later recovers again. But it's not that things would go extinct because of this drop. They're just not quite as good, and over time they would recover.
Mm.
In this particular study, we weren't so much concerned about new mutations, but basically what kind of solutions you can arrive at given a certain amount of variation. And in a real system, even if you had this transient drop, then sort of mutations would sort of allow you to pick up new mutations and basically recover the previous fitness and do this and arrive at where you were before. So I don't think this would be a viable strategy to eradicate any kind of nasty thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this side of the room.
Yes, I have a question. In terms of the...
Why don't you go ahead and... Go ahead.
In terms of the microbiome in a mother and a baby, the flora or fauna, whatever is in the, you know, the gut, would there be a difference, would you think, if the child were fed breast milk versus conventional? If the baby was breast milk fed, and the kind of delivery that was...
The delivery certainly makes a difference for the early population of the gut of, especially the skin, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm talking about cesarean, you know.
So,
canal.
I'm the wrong person to ask, frankly, but so this has been. I know it has been looked at in for skin microbiomes of kids that had what got delivered by cesareans and conventional delivery, and that certainly makes a difference.
It does.
For the gut, I'm not so sure. Okay. But well, the gut is sort of more or less sterile in the beginning and gets very rapidly populated by all kinds of things. And yeah, I would suppose it makes a difference, but just about anything makes a difference. So the question is whether it makes a
significant
difference we should care about.
Thank you.
How do you, a better understanding of the evolution of HIV virus, how will it help us to control the disease or the growth of its virus from a medical point of view?
Well, sort of the main problem we have with the disease is due to its rapid evolution. So one reason why we have so much trouble developing vaccines is because all of these vaccines are just easily evaded. And there's different issues, of course, too, because these proteins have lots of sort of sugars attached to them and they aren't readily accessible and sort of they hide the important parts and stuff. But, you know, I don't see sort of an immediate application, but understanding of what's going on will certainly, you know, help us in knowing where to look for solutions. So to the extent that evolution is a problem, it's sort of probably useful to understand. I guess that's all I can say.
The first step towards that?
I guess sort of an immediate step would, for example, be the drug resistance case, and people are doing that already. That you know, before you give drugs, you look at what does the genotype of the patient of the virus look like, and you know what kind of combination of drugs is it of least likely to be for the virus to get resistant to. So you basically tailor the therapy you give to a patient to the genotype the virus has, understanding what the evolutionary really is, so how easy it would be for the virus to attain drug resistance by evolution.
Thank you.
Richard is going to kill me because I introduced him as being biomedical So
I'm wondering, is there any sequence of protein, is there any sequence of protein, a signature protein that might be emitted before recombination takes place, with the thought that if you could inhibit the protein, you might inhibit the recombination?
Well, in case of HIV, the recombination is sort of mediated by template switching of the reverse transcriptase, and the reverse transcriptase in itself sort of is a major target of most drugs, but not to inhibit recombination, but rather to terminate transcription altogether. I think targeting recombination isn't quite immediate enough to be useful for treatment. Because this is, you know, the rate of recombination sort of very much affects sort of the long-term evolution. But if you want to treat things, You basically want to beat down the number of viruses in the blood as quickly as possible. And that also will reduce the amount of recombination that's happening, because fewer viruses are not going to see each other that often. So this is probably the better handle on recombination, just to try to reduce the virus population.
Hi, Sean Kelly from Santa Barbara. I'm just wondering, how would these models of drifting or mutation rate drifting apply to other organisms, like higher level animals? Could they be applied as well?
Well, so the processes are the same. The rates are different, and the environment is different.
Is it just a time scale, though?
So it's not clear to me how to scale things in various ways to obtain similar answers. Like, you make a model of an airplane and put it in the wind tunnel, and then sort of, you know, the big thing flies too. But I guess that's kind of what we are trying to find out, to some extent. We are sort of trying to find, you know, understand these sort of microscopic systems in greater detail, and then work our way up to sort of more complicated things and longer timescales. And we really still have to discover what kind of, you know, what are the relevant combinations of parameters that would allow us to compare things on different scales.
Yeah, can you predict what human beings will look like in 1,000 years?
My personal prediction would be that there aren't any. But that remains to be tested.
Okay, we should just thank you together.